For the last several decades, much of Latin America has been an experiment in democratization. But today that movement is increasingly threatened. Why?
The changes that the region has experienced over the last 20, 30, 40 years, I think have probably been beneficial in the net. And I think that even people today that feel somewhat unrepresented and unhappy about it, I would dare say that perhaps a big chunk of them would be even worse in the absence of, say, these pro-market transformations.
Welcome to The Pie. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland. Economists are always talking about the pie, how it grows and shrinks, how it's sliced, who gets the biggest share. In this show, we're talking about the most pressing matters of the day, seen through the lens of economics. The Pie is a production of the University of Chicago's Becker Friedman Institute. And in this episode, we're looking at growing anti-democratic sentiment in Latin America and the role economic policy has played in a rising tide of authoritarianism. As we will note repeatedly, Latin American countries are, of course, not carbon copies of one another, but there is a trend underway in the region that sets off alarm bells for anyone hoping to advance democratic capitalism. Today we explore what's happening and why, and the role of economics in all of it.
So my name is Luis Martinez. I am an assistant professor at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. And my favorite pie would have to be like a key lime pie, probably followed by a cherry pie.
I'd like to start with a broad overview of first Latin American politics and then their economies. And then we'll talk about the relationship between those elements. So with the acknowledgement that Latin America is made up of very different countries, each with their own identity, culture, politics, and it is an enormous landscape. All that said, can you give us a sense of where, in particular, democracy stands in that region of the world?
It certainly feels a bit like a turning point for the region. You have countries like my home country of Colombia that last year, well, not last year, 2022, elected a left-wing president for the first time in, some would say, its entire Republican history. Others, you know, for sure, in a very long time. So for a country like Colombia, it feels a bit like a democratic opening where voices that were previously unheard or did not have access to you know, the highest ranks of public office now have an ability to participate. You also have countries like, and so in Colombia, you have like the left wing taking over, but then you have countries like Argentina that also seem to be at a bit of a turning point in terms of you had this long, almost hegemony of left wing parties, you know, under the Kirchner family. And now there also seems to be an opening, I guess, in that case for almost for economic reform in particular. So it's interesting the way you frame your question, because certainly the economics and the politics seem to be very much intertwined in the current circumstances of the region. You have a country like Chile, which, you know, inherited the constitution of the Pinochet dictatorship, a constitution that was written more than 40 years ago, and despite several attempts at reform, were unable to do so. So as I look at all the countries in the region, I see certain lights and certain room for optimism, but also a lot of question marks as to what is to happen in the near future.
Can you give us a sense of the region's importance to the United States?
Well, you know, traditionally we've thought of Latin America as the U.S.'s backyard. And so you think of these very salient events, like, say, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which have this flavor of the United States making very clear that Latin America is within its exclusive sphere of influence. At the same time, in Latin America, there's always been a certain anti-US flavor or trend in its political leaning. So say the left wing in Latin America has always been a bit critical of what they would describe as American imperialism, if you will. But certainly, when you look at foreign policy, the U.S. has always found strong allies in countries like Colombia, for instance. And if you look at recent events where we see how countries like Venezuela, which I haven't mentioned so far, have developed increasingly close ties with countries like Russia, China, Iran. And this is certainly something that the U.S. government looks at, you know, keeps a close watch on.
So for some historical context, how did we get to this point, particularly in those countries where democracy seems most threatened at this point in time? What are some of the root causes of popular embrace of non-democratic rule?
So the root cause in most cases just seems to be governments that or regimes more broadly that systematically fail to deliver for their population. So if you think of countries where democracy has been really at risk, a country like Brazil, for instance, mm-hmm. you see that how did Jair Bolsonaro come to power? Well, Jair Bolsonaro came to power as a result of this profound disillusionment with the Workers' Party that had been in power for a long time. And more generally, you know, with the institutional framework that was developed since the country returned to democracy in the 1980s and, you know, its inability to deliver economic results for a large segment of the population. So essentially, you have a situation where you see that these politicians start saying more radical things, start embracing more radical policies, and voters seem to go along with that, always to the extent that these, say, more extreme candidates are able to deliver for them. And so another example that comes to mind in that regard is, say, if you look at a country like El Salvador that reelected President Bukele only a few days ago, there's a similar trend there where the country, you know, and in El Salvador, it's probably even more extreme because while Brazil was certainly embroiled in a deep political crisis, El Salvador was pretty much a failed state where organized crime and gangs had become almost immune or had gone beyond the reach of the state, beyond the reach of the state security apparatus. They were pretty much a state of their own. And so in the case of El Salvador, you see that, you know, Bukele got reelected by a huge margin. Like he doesn't seem to be very respectful of political institutions, of checks and balances, of the rules of the game. But certainly, as far as I can tell, he does seem to have very strong popular support. And why is that? Well, because basically he took this country that was extremely dysfunctional, on the verge of collapse, if not collapsing already, and through a series of like very draconian security measures that certainly put, you know, civil liberties, put important restrictions on civil liberties and human rights, he was able to kind of turn around the security situation. Hmm. So in all of these cases, it feels like the threat on democracy, or even, you know, that can potentially lead to the demise of democracy, is almost self-inflicted in the sense that most of these people come to power through democratic means, and they come to power basically because people are tired and disillusioned, and these leaders are able to offer, you know, a bit of a vision. I'm not sure that they're able to offer results, say Bukele, at least in the short term in terms of security, people seem to be happy with him. But at least these people, these leaders that pose a threat to democracy, part of their lure and their charm is their ability to sell a vision of the future that voters can embrace. You know, to some extent, it ends up happening that and you could say the same about Petro in Colombia as well, where to some extent you have the traditional parties giving the same old boring speech over and over, you know, kind of eat your vegetables, you know, fiscal prudence, yeah. Eat your vegetables type of thing. And then you have these other guys that just rock the boat. And for Argentina, you know, you see the same pattern where an important reason why Milei became president of Argentina was his smart use of social media and his ability to captivate younger voters. And so, again, it's this kind of a bit disruptive, a bit anti-establishment message, where the interesting and the worrying aspect of it at the same time is, okay, you know, to what extent are these people willing to still operate within the established rules of the game and the, you know, the democratic institutional framework that these countries have developed?
You mentioned Chile earlier, and of course, last year marked the 50th anniversary of that military coup that installed Pinochet. What does it tell you that this is where we are half a century after that watershed event and after decades of democratic progress?
Chile is a fascinating country, one that I have been studying for several years now. And, you know, for a political economist, it should be like the ground zero where you go to learn about political institutions, political regimes, and so on. It's a fascinating setting because certainly when the military coup occurs little over 50 years ago, as you rightly mentioned, you know, Chile is kind of an average country in terms of development in Latin America, if anything, perhaps a bit below the curve. And it is certainly true that it is one of the economic success stories of the past, you know, 40, 50 years. At least certainly within Latin America, Chile stands out. And so one thing that I would certainly emphasize is that the Chilean economic miracle is a real one. And it's undeniable. And since we're in the BFI podcast, of course, an important part of that story has to do with the involvement of these team of economists that come to be known as the Chicago Boys. And so certainly, you know, and this is a team of economists that were for the most part trained here at the University of Chicago's economic department, and that play a prominent role in the design and implementation of most of the reforms that the Pinochet regime implements. And so I say that Chile is a fascinating place because so you have these very dramatic and certainly tragic regime change. And I say tragic because it is well documented, all the human rights abuses that took place under the Pinochet regime. Some of our own research with my regular co-authors on this topic, we look at the impact of repression under Pinochet. But at the same time, you have these almost unheard of economic takeoff, at least for the region. And then that brings us to the present juncture where, so now the country returned to democracy in 1990. So, you know, it's been almost 30 years of democracy. Mm-hmm. But still today, you can kind of see the legacy. And, you know, there's certain traces of the impact of the dictatorship that are still seen today. A very prominent one I already mentioned, which is just the fact that the constitution that in effect in Chile today is the constitution that was drafted by Augusto Pinochet under very undemocratic conditions in 1980. But then at the same time, there's also this interesting interplay between the economic success, which you can think of it as the enlargement of the pie, no pun intended in terms of the name of the podcast. but so you're sure, enlarging the pie, but at the same time, as economists, we've always had this strong interest in the interplay between growth and efficiency, enlarging the pie, but also distribution, who gets it. And my reading of Chile, which is strongly based on my own research in this area, is that Chile is a country that grew a lot, but to the extent that the growth was bolstered by these reforms that lacked a strong democratic consensus, the people that were left behind, say the losers of this reform, were not really compensated in some meaningful way. So essentially you have this segment of the population that feels a bit left behind, that feels a bit not included in these several decades of growth. And those are the people that explain, you know, the protests in 2019, that explain Gabriel Boric's rise to power in 2021, that explain the movement for a new constitution. So essentially, you have this strong tension between the dictatorship and the economic growth and prosperity that it brought about, but also kind of the undemocratic roots of that growth and what that implies in terms of, say, the design of political institutions going forward.
So what do we know about how Latin Americans feel about their economic situations, particularly those who have experienced democratic capitalism? It sounds like they do not feel that it's working for them.
It's an interesting question because as an empirical microeconomist, I cannot help but wonder whether people in Latin America are able to think clearly about the counterfactual to their current situation.
What would it be like if we didn't have this?
Exactly. So, you know, if you go back to the early 1980s on the political front, you have a bunch of non-democracies, especially in the Southern Cone. You have economies that are heavily regulated, a lot of state intervention, which is in these cases, maybe not necessarily everywhere else, but certainly in these cases, you have a lot of inefficient state-led industry, that type of thing. And so certainly, the changes that the region has experienced over the last 20, 30, 40 years, I think have probably been beneficial in the net. And I think that even people today that feel somewhat unrepresented and unhappy about it, I would dare say that perhaps a big chunk of them would be even worse in the absence of say, these pro-market transformations, which, you know, it's a hypothesis that I've had for a while about, say, people's current attitudes towards democracy. And part of it has to do with lacking sufficient exposure to the alternative. So my sense is that if you go back to that period where people got to see what a non-democracy was like, you know, in the middle of the Cold War and so on, those people embraced democracy to a larger extent. I feel that people today, maybe it's a byproduct of this whole narrative of, you know, the end of history and we just see capitalist democracies everywhere, that people tend to think of democracy as a bit of a luxury good and something that is not strictly necessary. Hmm. You know, in that regard, there's some very interesting research by some other authors for Chile, for instance, that shows that the people that were able to participate and vote in that plebiscite in 1988 that got Pinochet out of power, those people still today vote at higher rates.
Huh.
And so to me, that's a fascinating finding because, you know, you're talking several decades later, but it's almost, you know, these people, they didn't have to tear down the Berlin Wall. It wasn't like a physical act, but certainly there's a sense of, I participated in this pivotal event that brought democracy to my country. And these people do seem to cherish that and take that for the rest of their lives. So certainly I think that the disenchantment with democracy and with kind of the free market economic environment, part of it has to do with these reforms and these type of institutions not fully delivering. So many countries in the region have poverty rates that exceed, you know, 40%.
Wow.
You know, high 30s, 40%. We're talking, and even countries that we would think of as relatively developed. So say Argentina, I looked it up recently, has poverty rate above 40%. Hmm. So it is hard to say that the reforms have truly delivered for everyone. But at the same time, I do think that people tend to forget how bad things were before, both in terms of lack of democracy, but also this heavily regulated economy full of inefficiency, lacking innovation, entrepreneurship, competition.
Well, so let me ask you about a few of those things that you just mentioned. You know, again, I feel like I have to keep saying with the caveat that Latin America is not a monolith, right? We're talking about numerous countries, differing economies. But what are some of the other major trends that are helping to shape those economies right now?
A key factor that joins most of Latin America and that relates a lot to what I was saying earlier would be the the very high prevalence of informality. So people that do not work for a formal firm, that pay social security, that pays taxes. In many of these Latin American capitals, you walk around and you just see a bunch of people selling stuff on the street. And even if they're not literally on the street, they will have like these little shops set up, you know, in these very informal shopping malls where, again, they're kind of, they fly under the radar of the state in terms of paying taxes, paying social security for their workers, and so on. And so part of the disillusionment, I think, has to do with that, because, of course, these are people that live in a very precarious economic situation, you know, very much month to month. Like, it's very hard to save for the future. These people do not have pensions. In many cases, they will have limited access to healthcare, health insurance, and so on. So certainly, informality, I think, is a defining feature of the economic landscape of the region that kind of shapes some of these things. The other would be a strong reliance on natural resources. So if you think of a country like Venezuela, you know, I could reproduce the history of the country over the last 60 years just by showing you a graph of the price of oil. So when the price of oil is going up, things are going well, you get a certain level of political stability. But when the price of oil goes down, you get the opposite. So for instance, if you look at the 1980s, 1990s, the price of oil is low and stagnant, and that makes people unhappy with the system. That's what brings Hugo Chavez to power. And then in the early 2000s, there's this rise in the price of oil and this broader commodity boom. And that's when, you know, Chavez is at his peak. He's even giving money to other countries. There was this famous episode where Chavez goes to England and I don't know if he eventually did that or not, but he offered free oil for the buses in London, despite his country having all sorts of needs. But still, that gives you a sense of the profligacy of the regime. And then in 2013, Chavez dies, but that also coincides with the price of oil going down. And so the problems of the Chavista regime are not so much that the current president, Nicolas Maduro, is not as charismatic and perhaps not as competent as Chavez, but also that he has less money in his wallet, in the public purse, than Chavez had. And you see that in other countries as well. You know, in the case of Colombia, oil is, even though Colombia is a tiny country in terms of the oil market, oil is our main export today. And so that has important implications for policy, say, to the extent that a country like Colombia that now has a left-wing government has been trying to embrace an ambitious environmental agenda, an ambitious transition away from fossil fuels. But again, if oil is the main source of foreign currency, it's one of the main sources of government revenue, it's not something that you can just do from one day to the next.
Well, let's end by talking about some solutions here, assuming that the end point is a flourishing democracy, and that's what is desired. If you were making policy, what kind of recommendations would you have, particularly in the sphere of economics, to allow this region to get to a stronger point of democratic influence?
That's a very good question. It's something that I wonder a lot. So say my own work, like I study a lot local governments in Latin America, and I sometimes wonder if I was somehow magically put in, you know, to lead one of these governments, would I be able to make a difference with everything I have studied and everything I have learned? Mm-hmm. And I sometimes wonder whether, you know, do we have some type of silver bullet that can easily make a difference? Or are there like these structural problems that cause trouble? I think that policy-wise, it is certainly dangerous when you take this pragmatic view that puts a lot of weight on outcomes and perhaps not enough weight on means and processes. So, for instance, if you think again of a guy like Bukele in El Salvador, you have these outcomes that people seem to like, But then also, from what I was reading not before the election, apparently there were some restrictions on, say, presidential re-election in the country. And basically, by reshuffling people in the high courts and, you know, kind of putting some pressure on the right decision makers, the country was able to say, okay, no, yeah, we'll let Bukele get reelected. And so that's the type of setting that worries me a bit, where, you know, we say, okay, perhaps Salvadorian voters seem to believe that this person is doing a good job, and so we'll give them a pass in terms of these institutional checks and balances. But of course, when things are going relatively well, these checks and balances are not that, don't seem to be that big of a deal. But when things take a bit of a turn and all of a sudden we're not that happy with how things are going, that's when these things become valuable. You know, a prominent thing.
And when we start paying attention.
Yeah, for sure. And so I would say, if I were to think of, and I'm sorry, I guess I'm more of a political economist than an economist. So when you ask me the policies that I would prioritize, I would certainly prioritize, you know, democratic institutions and checks and balances, and try to ensure that these governments operate within a democratic framework. Now, I don't say this lightly, because there could easily be this tension between the ability to implement the policies that these countries need to kind of get out of some of these systematic problems that they face, but the implications of giving up on these checks and balances. So for instance, a country like Argentina, you know, it's hard for me to be optimistic, because you're in this situation where, on the one hand, you have these systematic dysfunctionality coming from many years of misgovernance, and there seems to be a clear path ahead in terms of what a successful economic reform would look like, which is very much in line with economic common sense, you know, getting rid of a bunch of price controls, getting rid of a bunch of subsidies that in many cases end up being even regressive and that take a heavy toll on the public purse. But then at the same time, what are you going to do in order to get these reforms through? So for instance, in the case of Argentina, even though the president just got elected, you know, there's some type of midterm election in 2025, only little over a year from now. And so you have this tension where you say, okay, do we get rid of the democratic checks and balances so that we implement the right economic policy, or do we keep this in line? And I guess that's where, you know, the lesson from Chile, I will reiterate, Chile is a fascinating country to study, kind of illustrates those trade-offs very nicely. It's true that you have a lot of economic success, but there are important costs, both in terms of human rights and civil liberties, but also in terms of distribution, winners and losers from these things.
Well, if you decide to run for office, do let us know.
Absolutely. Maybe a small, in a school board. I'll start something small and local where I can dominate the agenda.
Fair enough. Well, this was absolutely fascinating. Luis Martinez, thank you so much for your time today and for all this great information.
Thank you, Tess. It's been a privilege being on the show. I was expecting your call for a long time, being a regular listener of the podcast.
Oh, we're happy to have you on. Appreciate it. The Pie is a production of the Becker Friedman Institute for Economics and part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. If you'd like to keep in touch with the latest economic research from the University of Chicago, you can visit bfi.uchicago.edu/subscribe. Carry the Two is a show that pulls back the curtain to reveal the mathematical and the statistical gears that turn the world. Co-host Katie Witkowski and Ian Martin bring unique perspectives from the fields of mathematics and statistics to convey how mathematical research drives the world around us. With each episode tackling a different topic, subscribe to Carry the Two, part of the award-winning University of Chicago Podcast Network. Our theme music was composed by Story Mechanics, production assistants from the BFI Communications team. I'm Tess Vigeland, your host and executive producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.